Yes, Mayor.
Good evening, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Ann Holden, and I'll be presenting item seven tonight, a discussion of options for permitting agricultural treatment unit expansion in Hinckley. So the July 2013 certification of the environmental impact report sets the stage for us to now move forward and discuss some options to authorize PG&E to expand their chromium remediation activities. And following the certification at the July meeting, we heard from the board members to seek areas of agreement and that community support is very important to move forward with this remediation. So with that, we've come up with some just concepts to expand the agricultural treatment units only. At this time, we're not considering writing a permit to expand any of the in-situ remediation. And that is because of some of the concerns over the location of the byproducts, the manganese and arsenic that are generated through the in-situ that you heard about tonight. The EIR has a mitigation measure that requires that no in-situ remediation is expanded until that byproduct investigation is complete. So that's not on the table at this time. The other thing we're thinking about is to bring all of the existing agricultural treatment units that are operating on the landscape now into a new permit to go ahead and roll everything into one permit so that the EIR requirements will apply to all of the agricultural treatment units operating. So we won't have two separate permits going. So this summer, Water Board staff have come to Hinckley several times for some meetings. We've met with the Community Advisory Committee, their technical consultant, PG&E staff, also came to the Community Advisory Committee in September, and we've discussed PG&E put forth their proposal for expanding agricultural treatment units. We talked about the impacts of concern that we heard while we were developing the environmental impact report. Talked about how some of the monitoring and mitigation requirements in the EIR can address those concerns, and then also discussed some options on how to structure a permit to allow the expansion. So those will be the topics I'll talk about as well tonight. This is the graphic that Mr. Sullivan showed in his presentation. This is their proposed agricultural unit expansion. Again, the three units down here near the compressor station would be new, and then this up here would be an expansion of the of an existing treatment unit. The lighter green areas here are the ones that are already operating on the landscape. Again, these are chosen, especially the ones closer to the source area, will give a higher mass removal of chromium. Also, because of the endangered habitat species issues that you've heard about, these are likely to be able to be moved forward before those take permits are in place. And I'll talk a little bit about the timeline for that. And I just wanted to show a picture of the agricultural treatment unit with the drag drip irrigation. It's basically just an agricultural field that grows forage crops. You can see the drag drip irrigation lines here, and they're in direct contact with the soil and the root zone of the plant, so it's an efficient use of water. It also prevents the chromium from being sprayed into the air, which was a previous concern. So again, while we were writing the EIR and as we've talked to the community this summer, we've heard their concerns, primarily the lower groundwater table or groundwater drawdown due to increased pumping with these agricultural units that could affect the quantity of water available in domestic supply wells, water quality in supply wells that could be affected by the agricultural unit byproducts, primarily TDS, nitrate, and uranium. And we also heard from the community during some of our meetings that a gradual approach to expanding the agricultural treatment units is preferred, has a little more support. So I just wanted to step through a couple of the EIR requirements that are in the final EIR that will be written into any permit that we write. So this is how this monitoring and mitigation that you've heard me talking about for the last 3 years or so will actually become binding on PG&E. We will write it into the permit, and it will be a part of their monitoring program, and the mitigation measures will be put into the permit as well. So the EIR monitoring starts out, what this graphic is showing is just an example of the buffer zones for monitoring that would be required by the EIR. The big blue buffer is where pre-remedial baseline sampling in domestic wells has to occur. So PG&E needs to go out a mile away, down gradient and cross gradient from any new agricultural unit, and survey the groundwater elevations in domestic wells, as well as gathering well construction details as far as where the well screens are located. And they also have to collect data on byproducts, the TDS, nitrate, and uranium. Then that needs to go on for a year prior to establishing the agricultural units, or it can happen concurrently if it would hold up the expansion. And then during remediation, there's another buffer zone where domestic wells need to be monitored, again, for the groundwater elevations, the byproducts, and chromium, as is occurring now. There's a requirement that they do groundwater flow and contaminant transport modeling, as well as groundwater drawdown modeling on an annual basis. That needs to predict out for 3 years. Every year they need to do it, but look ahead 3 years so that we have plenty of advanced notice if the model is predicting that we're going to be seeing groundwater drawdown or water quality impacts. And then there is a requirement in the EIR for to determine what the actual impacts of agricultural units on TDS, nitrate, and uranium will be. We don't have great information on that now, on how the agricultural units themselves affect those concentrations of those constituents of concern. So PG&E, once the WDR is approved, we'll have to submit a plan to do additional monitoring to figure out not only the concentrations in domestic wells, but also how those byproducts percolate to the aquifer. So with all this monitoring, if monitoring or modeling indicates that we're seeing some of these impacts, the EIR requires PG&E to take actions called mitigation measures. Basically, it's for a domestic well that will be impacted, they need to provide replacement water to that well, or if there's enough advanced warning, for example, through the modeling exercises, they can make some adjustments and adaptively manage the remediation to avoid the impact altogether. And the replacement water options that the EIR discusses would involve, for instance, for the groundwater drawdown impact, to either drill a deeper well for that resident or do some well modifications such as lower the pump. That will work in certain areas where the aquifer is deep enough to accommodate a deeper well. In some areas, that won't work where we have the shallower aquifer. Wellhead treatment is another option, perhaps similar to the whole house replacement water systems. And then another option is an alternate supply that would be a piped-in supply, something similar to the Hinckley School Supplemental Environmental Project, where they're using upgradient wells to bring in clean water or to connect to an existing supplier. So the EIR lays out those options for alternate water supply. So now I just want to step through a couple of very conceptual approaches that we've thought of as far as writing the permit to PG&E so they can expand some of their agricultural units. As you recall, the EIR analyzed a worst-case scenario. The project area is really big. It analyzed the impacts of putting quite a few agricultural treatment units on the landscape. So one of the options that we could do is simply to write a permit that would allow PG&E to put the maximum amount of agricultural units that were analyzed in the EIR. Just write one permit that authorized that maximum amount, either acreages or groundwater pumping. We wouldn't need to come back in the future to write an additional permit if we needed to, for instance, put some agricultural units in that northern area up toward Harper Lake. So it would be a fairly efficient approach from a staffing workload point of view. I do want to point out that the agricultural treatment units in certain areas are really going to be limited by that state and federal wildlife agency permitting process. So we have to work with both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to get the habitat conservation plans and take permits to disturb the habitat that is in the project area. And so some initial conversations with those agencies, they're saying 4 years, that seems to be the magic number tonight, 4 years for an incidental take permit. So even if even though the option one of just writing one permit that just allows the maximum expansion, understand that it's not like there's going to be agricultural treatment units sprouting up throughout the valley. That's not how that would work for several reasons, and the wildlife permitting is a big speed bump in that process. So the EIR, as I talked about a couple slides back, has a whole lot of monitoring that's required. We kind of consider that just the floor of the monitoring that we could require. It's not the ceiling. We would consider to require additional monitoring where chromium in the irrigation water is higher than historically applied. For instance, some of those agricultural treatment units closer to the source area would have higher chromium in the irrigation water than they have typically applied. And so we would want to require more monitoring to make sure that the treatment efficiencies are what we've seen up by the Desert View Dairy. We would want to require perhaps some soil and plant tissue monitoring and vadosone monitoring to make sure that we really understand that those agricultural units in those areas are working the way we understand them to work based on the data we have now. We can also require additional monitoring where chromium in the irrigation water is greater than some, you know, X times greater than the receiving water concentration. This would particularly be an issue where there could be the chance that that if the chromium did percolate back to the water table and could affect a domestic well, we would really want to be watchful of that situation and require monitoring there. And then also, because some of these proposed agricultural units are down in the area where the in-situ remediation zone is operating, so they could be pulling up some of those in-situ byproducts in the irrigation water, we'd want to monitor and capture that and make sure that we weren't accumulating over some threshold value in soil, for example. So the second option we thought about was to do the limited expansion approach, and this is where we would write a permit, but we would put limits on the number of acres or the amount of pumping that would be authorized under that permit, so it would have a distinct ceiling as far as how many treatment units could be covered under that permit. This would explicitly support a go-slow approach. We could also require all that additional monitoring that I spoke of in option one. We would want to be really careful that we, so we would need to come back in the future, possibly, to write another permit if we needed to have more agricultural units than the permit allowed. So it could result in an additional permitting step in the future. And we would want to make sure that we did not write the permit such that we limited our ability to respond to impacts that we're seeing, or if we needed to get more agricultural units on the ground to adaptively manage remediation, we wouldn't want to overly limit ourselves. So we'd want to think carefully about the limit that we put in this permit. And then option three is described as a categorical approach. And this is where we would write categories into the permit that would be based on the risk of impacts or the threat to water quality. And this is an approach that we've used, for example, our timber waiver is structured this way, where we have six different categories of activities that involve more information as the from the project proponent as the project has more threat to water quality. And so we thought about some potential categories that we could structure for this. We could have some, you know, a low-threat category that would be the existing ATUs that we already have a really good data set on, those that are similar to those existing ATUs as far as chromium concentrations and such, and any of the treatment units that didn't result in drawdown that would require a piped-in water supply, because that's a As soon as you move into drawing down a well and the solution isn't just drilling a deeper well, but the solution needs to be an alternate water supply that's piped in, that's a much more complex mitigation measure, takes a lot more time. So we would consider that a higher threat activity and wouldn't put that in the low threat category. And then the next category could be the ATUs similar to the ones that are proposed down by the compressor station that have the higher chromium in the irrigation water or are near active in situ zones. And again, we would require more monitoring or information from PG&E to apply under that category. And then the last category could be those that would require some complex mitigation measures such as a piped-in water supply. If a ATU was proposed and they did some modeling and said, we're going to draw down three wells and those people are in the western area where the aquifer is really thin and the only way we can get them water is to bring in a pipeline, we would consider that a higher risk category and require additional planning or perhaps upfront mitigation before the agricultural treatment unit could be operated. These are all just really conceptual ideas, but just to give you a flavor of what it could kind of look like. So just to kind of put them all up on one slide, what we thought about is the first option of option one, the maximum expansion, could be the most efficient approach from a staff workload point of view, but may not be the most supported by the community. Although it's important to understand that wildlife agency permitting limits are going to limit expansion so that it at the end of the day, nothing is going to happen really fast in certain areas. So option two, the limited approach, best supports the go slow concept, likely would require an additional future permit for expansion, and we would want to be careful about not limiting ourselves too much so that we can't adaptively manage the remediation. And then option three, the categorical approach, this would work best for a larger acreage permit. There wouldn't be a whole lot of sense to develop a categorical permit and then only authorize six ATUs under it because you'd want to have a wide variety of project area because otherwise everything would just be quite similar. So this can be effective. We've seen this work well with the timber harvest program where it can really streamline the application process, helps the project proponent understand the kind of information they need to submit in order to get coverage for their particular proposal, and it also can really help prioritize the review process, both from a staff workload point of view and the public. If the public is going to be involved in reviewing some of these proposals, to know to really focus on the higher threat, and maybe some of the low threat ones don't need to be focused on as much. So staff can support any of these options that we mentioned tonight as long as, there's reasonable expansion beyond the existing agricultural treatment units and we preserve the ability to adaptively manage and respond to impacts or plume movement as needed. So what I'll recommend is just perhaps following board input and public comment that we reserve some time at the end to circle back and have some discussion on final conclusions and recommendations. And then I'm just going to put up a quick next step slide to toss out some dates on what we're thinking as far as developing and circulating the tentative WDRs. We're shooting for early December, and then we'd like to have an informational meeting in Hinckley. We plan to bring perhaps those WDRs just as a workshop informational item to the board in January on the 8th here in Barstow. And then for the March board meeting, bring the proposed WDRs to you for consideration. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. I don't believe we have any gold cards for this item. So I'm going to ask if there are questions or comments from board members, starting with Mr. Sandell.
The only question that I have is, would we be able to, in the analysis and mitigation, be able to address things that have happened just recently, like the, as we presented tonight, somebody whose well's gone dry inherently from PG&E activity, whether analysis would show that to be true, and if it did, would they be included in the mitigation? And could we build that into what we're proposing?
My understanding is that the EIR mitigation can't be applied until we've adopted WDRs.
Right.
However, I think Kim might have some insights into how that can be applied if it is shown to be a drawdown related to agricultural treatment.
If it was shown to be something that's continuing on, I mean, those mitigation measures would apply towards the future, but they wouldn't be retroactive.
You
could
have a bad
battery
now.
Yeah, I do too. If that pumping continued and it was under our WDRs, we would be able to apply the mitigation measures. But if we couldn't require mitigation for something that's happened in the past.
Anything else, Mr. Sandell? Mr. Jardine.
I have a quick question. The four-year standard, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, does that apply to all three options?
Yes, it does.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But just to be clear, we're looking at the current PG&E's current proposal. Because that those areas that they're one of the reasons they're proposing those areas is that they likely aren't biological habitat, and so we'll work with the Fish and Wildlife agencies to get some sort of thumbs up to move forward with those to get their concurrence that they're not habitat ahead of the take permits is I think how we're going to approach that. So the current proposal that PG&E has, we're hoping to move that forward quicker than 4 years. Okay.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to go with option two initially, but going to listen.
Mr. Dias?
Yes, thank you. Could we pull up the slide, the title of Agricultural Treatment Unit Expansion Community Concerns?
Number seven.
Seven, yes. Regarding the potential water quality impacts of irrigated water, I think we have faced that problem before, and I think we found a solution to it. In other words, several years ago, when the LA County Sanitation District proposed to irrigate with reclaimed wastewater in the Antelope Valley on agricultural units there, I think when we wrote the waste discharge requirements, we included language that prohibited application of water in excess of the agronomic rates. And therefore required all the water be taken up by the plants and there would be no migration of the groundwater. Can we not do that in this case?
I believe we can do that, and I'm pretty sure we have that in the current DVD permit, that it must be applied at agronomic rates. And that's definitely something that we can write into the permit. I think from what I understand, what happens is in the cooler months or when the seeds are just starting to germinate, that you apply it at agronomic rates, but it doesn't get completely uptaken because the plants are still so small and the evapotranspiration is very low. So, but it's a good thought, and as far as the impact of it, that's one of the reasons why we're requiring those investigations, because most of the TDS issues that we're seeing near those agricultural treatment units, such as the Desert View Dairy that are currently operating, it's very hard to separate out what are the impacts from the actual ag treatment and what came from the dairy operations. It's all, and I believe most of it is from the dairy operations. So we're going to try to figure out just how much of a problem TDS and nitrate will be. The nitrate is actually predicted I believe the data from the Desert View Dairy shows that it's about a 90% uptake efficiency. So we're not expecting to have too much of a nitrate problem, but we're not certain. So that's why we identified it in the EIR as an impact that required additional investigation.
One more question. I think I understand the source of the TDS and the nitrates from past farming operations, but where does the uranium come from?
So the uranium is something that occurs in the bedrock, typically the granitic bedrock. It's a naturally occurring constituent in the aquifer. It's not something that is added or part of the remediation process. But the concern with the uranium is not that it will be added. It's that it'll be mobilized up from the deeper areas of the aquifer as we're irrigating, and then sprayed onto the soil and accumulate in the soil, and then possibly percolate back down to the groundwater. So that's another one of those kind of, we don't have great data on it, but when PG&E was doing some sampling for some of those northern pivots, they were coming up with some higher uranium concentrations above the MCLs in their sampling. So it triggered us to think about that as a potential impact.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt board questions and comments. I have speaker cards. I remind you of the target of 5 minutes or less. Billy Hernandez.
Our concerns as the CAC, when we were looking at their fields that they want to put in, we were more okay with the fields next to the compressor station because there's really not that much housing around there. We were really concerned about the one up top that they wanted to do. I think it was number 4. Some of the things that we've seen was the drawdown of water in some areas was going to be as high as 24 to 28 feet. And that I think is going to impact like Mr. Arguello's farm down there. What they're drawing out of those wells and those irrigation fields that they have towards the north, it's in the millions of gallons. I mean, it's quite substantial. And then, if I remember correctly, the uranium that you were just talking about, it was in the tons also that was already on the ground. You know, there was a big issue about that. They keep telling us that uranium isn't dangerous, but there was a ton of it. And with all the winds that we have here, the people were concerned about that too. So I just wanted to, you know, they are pumping quite a bit up north and they control the flow of the plume a lot of times. When you look at the picture of the way the plume is, it's usually in a northwest diagonal. And that's where that finger was going out too. So they do a lot of pumping toward the east, but that's some of the things that I wanted to keep you reminding you. You know, they're doing a lot of pumping up there, and I think it's restricting a lot of the flow of water. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Darren Banks.
I just wanted to basically what Billy Hernandez is talking about. We've spent a lot of time talking about this within meetings of everybody involved. But, you know, they make the point of saying, like, for instance, the pumping going up to the north. You mentioned Mr. Aguado's case. I mean, essentially what their claim is they've been able to stop the flow, which the thought of idea is to stop the flow of chromium 6 to continue to go. But what the theory has, now that northern part's not getting the recovery rate that it needs to fill up, so he's pumping it for his tomatillos, okay, but the water's not coming back down to get back down and fill up so he can pump it back up again. He's not getting what he needs to feed his plants. And that's one of our big concerns. We're happy that the EIR covers, and I'm sure that wasn't PG&E's intentions, and there's still, both views of what's going on up there, and I think there's going to be further investigation to see what's going on in there. But you know, that Dr. Isbick even brought that to me. That could be partially what's going on with Mr. Aguas, and we don't know until we see. And then something that's not even discussed here is the amount of chromium 3 that's being put back down into our aquifer. It's you know, we're saying that the percentage of the alfalfas, which is the chromium 6 to chromium 3, and then even the chromium 3 that's flowing through the IRZs, all of that chromium 3, it's still not supposed to be there, but it's being put there either through the IRZ or down through the ag units. Now, part of the study is to look at the recharge rate. What, you know, and you know, it's felt that it's much more substantial than what earlier thought. So leaving that chromium 3 down there, is the saying comes up, is we're just chasing our tail. Because what can happen is as it recharges, reoxygenates, and then that chromium 3 can turn back into chromium 6, and then we have that same problem. And if I could just, Mrs. Cox, you asked a question about when Mr. Sovin was showing the wells and stuff. There's the levels that the domestic wells are screened at. You know, you could have chromium 6. That's what you see when there's a domestic well and you have a monitoring well. The domestic well may say 1.2, but the monitoring well next to it will say 3.8 or 3.6 or whatever. It's because, like, my domestic well is drilled deeper. It's screened down deeper. Okay, so the water gets pulled down. This is how it was explained to me. The water's pulled down, and the even the chromium 6 water gets pulled down, but it gets diluted back up and it goes into my thing. So when the readings come down, it doesn't necessarily mean that all these people have 0.05 or whatever Mr. Sullivan believes in their water. We could have 5.8 here, but we're pumping from here. And so, I mean, in the northern area where they cut off, there's a 19, there's a 6.6, there's a 4.8, okay, in the area that he cuts off. So I mean, it's something that I think that we all need to take into account. It's not, it's how you say it and the way it's said that, like I said, just because the domestic well doesn't show it doesn't mean that chromium 6 isn't up above in the upper layers. And you can confirm that. Ask. I mean, it's true. So, thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Sullivan.
Yeah. Kevin Sullivan, PG&E. I do want to note, and I actually want to thank Darren and Billy and the work that they put in. You know, I think there's a lot of things. We've been through an awful lot of meetings, and they're challenging for those of us who do this professionally. And I know these guys have climbed quite a hill on getting up to speed on this stuff. And you know, I'll also say that I think the EIR's done a good job of analyzing. You know, I think we've identified these issues. The pre-monitoring is a big one. You've heard us say, you know, if we only knew what was here before we started, we're going to do that. So I think a lot of these boxes have been checked, and we're very supportive of doing this. We'd like to get going, so we'd be supportive of whatever permitting process gets us to that first step. I'm kind of a believer, given the complexity, that let's hit a few singles and not go for the home runs. The one thing I did want to address, just because I think there's some misinterpretations going on, related to the Aguayo's well. It's a challenging situation. Mr. Aguayo's well was not yielding the levels that it was before. We checked all of our monitoring wells in the years. We haven't seen a water level drop. Our nearest pumping well is several miles away, and the drilling activities that were going on there were for monitoring wells. And we had a kind of a unfortunate circumstance that these monitoring wells were being drilled in response to the board order that you're going to get the report on next week. We were drilling those wells in the middle of the summer. Apparently, our driller went out there the day after Mr. Aguayo was finding his pump, wasn't yielding the water anymore. Mr. Aguayo basically threatened our drill crew. The quote was, if you drill that well, I will shoot you. Sheriff was called. It was a fairly tense 24 hours as we to kind of backed off, stood down. We've tried to take what we call the good neighbor approach. You know, we had camera rigs out there. We said, hey, you know, we're here. We're happy to tell TV your well, try to figure it out. We pulled out, we looked at the TV, came up with some suggestions, suggested a pump test. Mr. Aguayo at that point said, thank you very much, you know, we're on. So we've tried to be a good neighbor on this one. Our nearest pumping well is multiple miles away. We're happy to monitor this. We've done preliminary modeling of what the groundwater will be. There'll be a monitoring program in place so that we all can see through both monitoring well networks and domestic wells what the impacts of our drawdown are. We take this issue very seriously.
Thank you. To return to board comment and questions, in light of the public comment, Mr. Jardine, do you have anything else?
No.
Mr. Sandell?
I don't have a clear favorite of the three approaches that have been discussed. I think that perhaps when staff brings it back to us, they will come to some conclusions on their own. I think I could go with either of the three. I think that go slow is probably going to happen just because of all the other considerations that are bearing on this, and so I think I'll just await events.
Mr. Diaz?
I share Mr. Hernandez's concerns about the aquifer drawdown, so I would prefer option 2, the limited expansion approach.
Ms. Cox?